Welcome to Worlds Apart. It's the economy, stupid, has been the axiom of American and Western political thinking even before it helped Bill Clinton win the 1992 presidential election. The pursuit of money and profits above everything else has guided the US's development and global expansion since the nation's creation. But with the dollar system now reaching its objective limits, what may possibly come in its place? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alan Freeman, co-director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba. Mr. Freeman, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, I was initially intending to discuss with you the war in Ukraine, and I still hope we can touch upon it in the second part. But before we go there, let us look at the recent banking collapses in the United States. And I wonder if you see any connection between these seemingly isolated and domestic events with the larger U.S. Policy, both monetary and foreign policy.
There is a connection, but it may go in the opposite direction to what your viewers may think, which is I don't think that the banking collapse is caused by the Ukraine war. I think the Ukraine war is caused by the banking collapse. And the reason is that this collapse like this occurs every 10 years. It's just the last time was 2008. In 2000, there was the dot-com. In 1992, was the so-called oil crisis. It's a feature of the way that this economic system works. And the curious thing is every time it happens, people think there's a new reason for it. So there's always, this was caused by toxic acids. This was caused by, it's the system, dummy, as Bill Clinton probably would not have said. And the system is one that in which the assets that should be invested in production are increasingly being diverted into speculation in finance. And the reason for this is a systemic weakness of the economy. If you look at the long-term performance of the US economy and those of the global north, Japan and Europe, it's no different. You'll find that there has been a systematic, steady, what we call secular decline, really since 1960. The US economy received a huge boost from the war, from the Second World War, and it's gone down ever since. It's now got to the point where it is no longer profitable to invest in production. So people invest in these risky financial assets, and each time in the cycle, the assets are overvalued, and then there is a crash and a credit. Ukraine war is a response to that weakness.
Now, the connection that I see, and let me know if I'm wrong here, has to do with the United States once again exceeding its debt ceiling of over $31 trillion. But instead of closing the government as required by the law, the Federal Reserve with the Treasury are now engaging in various, what they call extraordinary operations that allow the government a certain lifeline, but dry up the liquidity on the market, which may have contributed to the collapse of some banks and service difficulties at other banks. The fact that the American government has to use all these extraordinary measures instead of just printing out money as they've done before, isn't it a sign of the dollar economy exhausting itself?
It's very simple. If you're going to print debt, somebody has to buy it. And the traditional way the U.S. has worked when it's confronted a crisis since 1947, but 1987 was very typical, the Asian meltdown. You force foreign people to buy your debts. That's what you do, because America is in this unique position that its currency is a world currency. What we're now beginning to see is a systemic crisis caused by the difficulty of maintaining a domestic currency, which is also a world currency. Now, there are two things happening. First of all, increasingly, American debt is being financed by Americans because Russia and China and all the people who are forced, Japan even, who are forced to accept American debt are no longer accepting it or are reducing their exposure. The second thing that's happening is that the situation when you have an asset, when assets are overvalued, you have a terrible choice. You either have to increase the federal interest rate in order to damp down inflation, and you then basically encourage people to speculate in financial assets, or you have to reduce the interest rate in order to damp down the speculation, but then inflation will go. So it's more of a dilemma than a knockdown crisis. I think there's a famous saying that used to be said for Marxists, that they predicted five of the last four crises. That, you know, we're always sort of those of us who are a bit Schadenfreude with the American difficulties tend to say it's all terrible. Really, there's a dilemma. Now, what I think is now happening is that the Fed is going to decrease interest rates, and that will allow them to damp down the speculation. And to some extent, I think it's yet to be seen whether the extent of this, which I don't think we're looking at a knockdown crisis. The difficulty will be that there will be inflation, and that will provoke domestic dissent, because it will affect poor people. And poor people in America have for a long time increasingly been the target, along with the global South and Russia and China, of American ire. So I think that the threat that we can be certain of is that it will increase domestic discontent within the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say that the Western elite's views on economics have become a sort of a religious system, in a sense that everything starts and ends with money and accumulation of profits. But any sustainable religious system requires some humbling rituals and a certain amount of self-discipline, specifically aimed to keep the practitioner's ego in place. Isn't that the main problem with the Western-driven sort of economic-centered worldview, that it's simply incapable of limiting its appetites, even for its own sake?
Well, I think they are very disciplined. They discipline people to do stupid things, and people carry out those stupid things in a very disciplined way. And they also are particularly disciplined at perpetuating their teachings. So quite interestingly, after the 2008 crash, Greenspan, I think it was, came on, testified to Congress, this has challenged absolutely everything I know, everything we thought was wrong. 3 years later, he produces a book in which he says, no, it was all right. We just had to tweak a few things. That, to me, is a sort of Jesuitical, if you want, a religious analogy, which is you say, okay, there's a few problems, but we can patch them up with some sophistical reasoning. And that's what they do. They don't acknowledge the fundamental things that are wrong with the economy, which is this long-term decline, its tendency to decline, process of financialization, imperialism, the unsustainability of the imperial world order, that they don't recognize as wrong. They only tweak the edges.
Mm-hmm. Now, a budget department of the U.S. Congress announced recently that by 2032, within a decade, the American cost of servicing its debt will top the U.S. defense expenses, which are humongous. I think there are more than 10 other countries combined. What do you think it would mean in practical terms, both for the United States or for the larger West and for the world?
Well, I'm not I don't want to be rude, but I'm not a soothsayer. I used to work as a practicing economist, and they've taught me only one thing is, in the words of the famous US baseball player, never predict anything, especially the future. So it's very dangerous to say, oh, this is immediately going to lead to a meltdown. I think what the task of what Radhika and I call political economy or geopolitical economy is to analyze the social and political consequences rather than try and call every immediate economic happenstance. What will certainly happen is that the burden of this will fall on everybody that the American elites don't want to make pay for it. They're making the Germans pay. That's why they blew up Nord Stream. They're making the Europeans pay. That's why they're forcing them to actually send all the weapons to Ukraine. They're not sending their own on the whole. And so they're finding that increasingly difficult, but they will now try and be forced to take out some of these difficulties on the American people. I mean, at the end of the day, as I say, the debt burden is increasingly falling on the shoulders of Americans. Less and less are other countries accepting that they will hold American debt and pay for it. Therefore, more and more, and this is, I think, what the elites in America are really frightened of, they will have to confront the anger of their own people. So that's the consequence that I would draw from these, rather than I have no idea. I'm not a banker, right? I mean, I have no idea what the debt burden will do. Some people have extraordinary debt. Japan has an extraordinary debt burden as the percentage of GDP, and the economy just sort of plods along. So I would be hesitant to say, although it may be, you know, that this is the ultimate knockdown crisis. I don't sort of look at things in that way.
Well, when I'm asking you this question, I'm not looking for sort of, you know, the collapse of the US dollar system response. I think the most typical answer I heard from Russian economists is that the American currency will transition from being the world main reserve currency to being a regional currency, you know, one of many, but still a stronger one supported by the strength of the American industry or by the Western industry. Now, do you think that's a sustainable scenario for the Western world? Because as you pointed out in many of your articles, the Western economic dominance has been based over the last couple of centuries on essentially sucking resources from the rest of the world and redistributing it among its own allies. Can the Western camp, the Western part of the world, sustain itself only by its own means without exploiting the rest of the world in such a measure as it's been accustomed to?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And I agree with the analysis that you quoted, that what we're seeing is the end, the beginning of the end, and it's a long drawn out process of the capacity of the US dollar to function as the world's currency. But when you have something that is being dropped, something has to replace it. So the issue is not just whether the US cannot function as the world's currency, but what is put in its place. Now, what you're beginning to see is arrangements whereby either through currency swaps, for example, the relation between Russia and India, they trade in rubles and rupees. They don't have a joint currency or anything like that. But in other places, there's proposals afoot to create a BRICS currency, I believe, certainly in Latin America. Now, I think Mexico, maybe it was Brazil, correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea is certainly being floated of a Latin American free trade zone and currency zone. But to put these, and China is obviously developing swap arrangements with other countries. But what would be dangerous for, let's say, China, would be for its currency to become a world currency. Like, then it would be in the same mess that America has got it into. So I think one should see move towards a system of regional currencies without any single hegemon. If you do that, then you have to make the kind of arrangements that Keynes proposed at Bretton Woods, and he was defeated by the Americans, for a proper system of international settlements in which the priority is to secure the growth of the poorest countries rather than to make the poorest countries pay for what the rich countries are doing. And that's the way out. This is a long process. It combines economic, political, and geographical activities, the formation of regional blocs, the creation of workable trading arrangements, avoiding overexposure of currencies to the kind of dangers that the US is being exposed to, and so on. Ultimately, therefore, it's as much about the way that imperialism is declining as it is about the specific arrangements that are made. And now the third world countries, China, Russia, India, have to work together actually to create an alternative to the trade, to the US dominated trading system.
And I think they're already doing that, and the American sanctions are helping that a great deal. But let me reiterate that question once again. Do you think the West itself can live in such an arrangement when everybody is treated more fairly, and you know, when trade can be done in a way that is mutually beneficial rather than politically conditioned?
Well, of course, we must all wish for that. I would say until now, the prospects have not been particularly bright. And this is a puzzle, one of the things that exercises me, because for me, the issue in understanding what's going on in the West is, in a certain sense, not understanding how stupidly they're behaving, because that's very obvious. You only have to look at three graphs to tell you what they're doing wrong. The real problem is, why don't they understand it? And I have this little quote that I love from Bastiat, where he says, I'm not a great fan of Bastiat because he was reactionary in the French Revolution. He says, when plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over the course of time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it. Now, that's what they've done. They've created a mythological system in which they don't understand that their wealth rests on robbing the rest of the world. They literally don't understand it, because it's not a pleasant thing to admit that you're a bandit, all right? So what they do is they create a mythology in which they say the reason we're wealthy is because we're superior. As long as you think you're superior, you're not going to get your problems right. It's a superiority conflict. Until you understand why you don't understand, it's almost like Freudian, you know, the patient has to confront her or his own neurosis before he or she can put it right. And they're not doing that.
Mr. Freeman, I have to confront our own fascination with this conversation in order to take a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alan Freeman, co-director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba. Now, Mr. Freeman, let's now turn our attention to the war in Ukraine. And in one of your recent articles, you pose a question that I think doesn't have the right to exist in the Western universe. You ask if NATO won in Ukraine and if the Russian army was driven back to the border, would the world be a better or a worse place? And I'm sure it looks like a no-brainer to most of your countrymen. Why are you even asking a thing like that? Isn't that anathema to a Western ear?
I asked the question because of a defect in the Western so-called left. Even the far left, even the people you would expect would be very revolutionary and against NATO, because they have fallen prey to, I think, an illusory way of thinking, which is they think that Russia is an imperialist power. They think that China is an imperialist power. But
the United States is not, right?
Yeah, I mean, what they get wrong is very simple. Imperialism is not what a single country does. Imperialism is a system. And President Putin put it in a way I would agree with. I don't always agree with Putin, but I agree with him on this, that he says that essentially the colonial attitudes that have shaped the world and the colonial methods have been in place since 1492, and they're just being continued. So they don't understand that. So what I was trying to say is, well, look, you say you're against Russia. Okay, I'm not going to stop you being against Russia. I'm probably not going to stop you doing anything, because it's very difficult to stop stupid people being stupid. But I said, well, think, what will happen if NATO wins? Do you think this will be a good outcome? And the answer is no. And the reason is because the motivation of the NATO powers is fundamentally racist. Now, racism leads to genocide. It's very straightforward. They believe that they are superior. If you think that you are superior, and that's why you're rich, why is everybody else poor? You shut out of your mind the idea that they are poor because you are making them poor by robbing them, by getting to buy your false debts and all the rest of it. And you think, no, it must be because they are inferior people. What do you do with inferior people? You get rid of them. That's the attitude of the Americans to black people. That's the American attitude to Russian people, I'm afraid, to Chinese people. And so this is clear in Ukraine because of the cause of the war, which is this is a civil war. It's absolutely clear. You have a country in which 43% of the people, their native language is not Ukrainian, and you tell them they've got to talk Ukrainian or break the law. They can't do it. Of course, they're not.
Mr. Freeman, it's not just about telling them to learn the language of a nation. It's actually specifically making Russian ethnicity or Russian cultural heritage as, you know, being seen as incompatible with the Ukrainian civic identity. It's not something that you should be ashamed of. It's something that you can be killed because of. And I heard you suggest that it's akin to the United States banning Spanish or Canada banning French. And it indeed seems inconceivable in the Western context. And yet, when it comes to the Russian language, not only in Ukraine, but let's say in the Baltic states, why do you think that practice of, you know, explicitly, deliberately suppressing the Russian language, the Russian culture, the Russian mentality, why do you think it's been acceptable to the West?
I think that in 2014, I visited Crimea, and we met with people who had just been in the Odessa massacre, you know, when they were put into a trade union, driven into a trade union building, which was then set
and burned alive. Yeah.
Burned alive. What struck me was, I mean, because it's a horrible thing, but accidents can happen, but that the right-wing Ukrainian groups then posted pictures of the charred bodies on their social media networks. And I spoke to the people there, and it was absolutely clear that what was in process was a genocidal process, was a violent assault on people that the Ukrainian fascist group, far right, I know there is a left in Ukraine, it's deeply suppressed, but there is a left, and it, you know, I think that the opposition party of Medvedchuk was second in the polls before he was suppressed and made a prisoner, right? Okay, so they think that the Russian people don't belong there. When Zelensky says he wants to take back Crimea, he doesn't mean he wants the Crimean people. You can't take over a place in which 90% of the population hates you and is of a different civilization and culture, because they're going to fight, right? So what do? You kill them. It's intrinsically genocidal, this attitude that the only way that you can live in the territory which Ukraine claims for itself is to be a Ukrainian, leads to the conclusion that the people who are not Ukrainian should be eliminated. So it's a deeply racist, and it's entrenched in it. The question of why America supports it, I think in 2014, when Victoria Nuland was caught by the Finnish, I think it was the Finnish intelligence authorities, telephoning and saying to Ukraine exactly who they could have in their government, right? In other words, this was a government construct. One can debate whether it was a coup or not, okay? But what is indisputable is that that government was appointed by the United States of America, not by the people of Ukraine. And I think that was a decision of the neocon wing of American politics, that it was not possible to pursue American ends by so-called democratic liberal means. They would need to make alliances with fascists to do so. And I think there is now a very conscious awareness among certain sections of the American elites, not all of them, that they actually have to be in alliance with explicitly racist, genocidal, and fascist forces if America is to prevail in the world, which it will not, but that's their insane view.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that specific point, according to the Russian view of what the Kremlin essentially did with the launch of the military operation in Ukraine is to bring that proxy war that the West has been waging against Russia for at least the past 15 years into the open. And that was made not only for strategic, but for tactical reasons, because Vladimir Putin supposedly calculated that a clash with NATO was inevitable, that waiting for longer or trying to solve it diplomatically would not avert the confrontation. I wonder if that was your view as well prior to the launch of the Russian offensive. Did you think before that, that Russia and the West inevitably would confront each other in some way or another, kinetically?
I don't like to get engaged in conversations about internal politics of other countries. So I don't like to speculate too much about what may have motivated Putin. I will say this. I think that both sides were probably aware from 2014 onwards that a confrontation was inevitable of some kind, and there was a gearing up. I think that what seems to have been the belief in Russia was that there was a peaceful way out, and they thought that there was a peaceful way out because they thought European civilization would accept them. And I think this was a profound error, because European civilization is not a civilization, it's an empire, and they would never have allowed Russia in. They could never have allowed Russia to become an influential part of the sphere of European politics. And I thought what was very interesting about the speech that Vladimir Putin gave at the Valdai Club was that he specifically spoke of what is Europe, and he spoke of the two Europes. And I think the vision of Europe that he has is the correct vision, which is that there is Eurasia, and within that, Europe could play its part. So at some future time, I think that there could be a general coming together of the Eurasian nations, let's say, in a polity which might include Europe. But the idea that this could be achieved, and that I have spent a lot of time in Turkey. Turkey, for many years, thought that they would be accepted as the European Union. There was no way the European Union could accept a country that has a bigger army than anybody else in Europe. They couldn't have accepted it. So this illusion that European civilization will let you in was a danger, and I think that was the problem. Europe is a fortress. That's what it is.
But Dr. Freeman, when you talk about European civilization, when I think about this term, it includes spirituality, it includes culture, it includes very diverse history, it includes certain diplomatic tradition, like, for example, the European concert. It's a massive heritage that both Russia and Turkey have benefited from, and some could argue that they actually the true preservers of that heritage. And I think Putin, in his Valdai speech, underlined that despite this current conflict with the Western financial and political and military elites, Russia remains a truly European culture or country by persuasion. And unlike some European nations, we are not going to ban European culture. And I see a lot of investments now going into the ancient Greek art, into various European cultural traditions. So hopefully this war, this existential crisis that we are facing right now, will allow at least some of us to preserve certain amount of European heritage. Anyway, we have to leave it there, but it's been a great delight for me to talk to you.
For me also. Thank you so much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.